Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Well, my notes tell me we have Bigfoot High School here. If that's correct, would you all please stand up so we could say hello? Oh, wow, wonderful. Well, welcome to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Please be seated. After the argument today, Justice Dallet will wave at him, will come out and chat with you a little bit about proceedings in the Supreme Court. She won't talk with you about the case you will hear in a few minutes, but she'll tell you a lot of interesting things, and she likes hard questions, so be sure to give her a couple.
Not too hard.
Okay.
I can take it.
Well, let me just look here. We have the usual order. Okay. 25:30 and back for 5. Okay. Very good. Are you prepared to proceed, counsel? Please.
May it please the court, Michael Cohen, Meisner Tierney, staff of Petitioner Employers Insurance of Wausau. The Wausau policies contain clear, unambiguous, and enforceable consent before assignment provisions that preclude assignment of policy coverage without Wausau's consent. The parties to those contracts, Wausau on the one hand, and Old Waukesha Foundry and New Waukesha Foundry on the other hand, depending on the policy periods, agreed to those clear provisions decades ago. Consistent with the Red Arrow decision from the Court of Appeals, which has been relied upon by insurers and insureds for the last 22 years, these unambiguous provisions should be applied as written to preclude the rights of Pneumo Abex for coverage under the Wausau policies and not rewritten 45 to 55 years after the issuance of these contracts. Contrary to the Court of Appeals decision below, the Court of Appeals conclusion in Red Arrow that the identical consent before assignment provision was unambiguous and precluded assignments of policy coverage without Wausau's consent was germane and essential to its holding.
Counsel, write in the opinion, it says the parties agreed there was no assignment. So Red Arrow isn't really on the same footage as we are here. The parties haven't agreed there's no assignment.
That is a distinction, but a distinction without difference for purposes of its binding precedent, and I will explain. I was counsel for Wausau in that case 22 years ago, and there were two issues that the court had to decide on the assignment issue. First, was the assignment a contractual transfer? And secondly, if so, whether the consent before assignment clause precluded that transfer. And the argument that was raised in that case by New Red Arrow, who was a stranger to the Wausau policies, was that the policies transferred by operation of law. So the court had to take a look at the first question, was there a transfer? No, contractually. And then secondly, did they transfer by operation of law? And a major argument that we made on behalf of Wausau and briefed in that case was they couldn't transfer by operation of law because of the consent before assignment clause, which was...
And there also was no assignment. That was germane to your argument, too, correct?
The first prong of the attack was there was no assignment, and they couldn't transfer by operation of law because of the agreement of the parties, which the court had determined was clear and unambiguous. In fact, New Red Arrow didn't even argue it was ambiguous, just as Pepsi Metro does not argue here. So that part of the conclusion of the Court of Appeals was, in fact, essential and germane to its decision because there was an open issue as to whether there was a transfer by operation of law. And we argued strenuously that by contract, New Red Arrow, if they did stand in the shoes of Old Red Arrow, couldn't argue that because contractually they agreed that they had to get our consent, Wausau's consent, before they could make any sort of assignment. So it was essential. It was not dicta. The Court of Appeals erred by concluding it was dicta. It was dispositive, and they were not authorized by Cook v. Cook to overlook that decision. It should have been binding on that court.
So, counsel, I don't hear you arguing to us that it's that these provisions mean that you cannot that there must be consent before transferring. You're making a distinction between first and third party policy, and where do you get that from? I don't see the argument being the contract says it, therefore you must get consent before assignment.
Let me see if I understand your position. Is your question whether the condition provision that says that you need consent before assignment distinguishes between first and third party coverage?
Well, it doesn't. And there's nothing in the policy that says that. So that is my question. Is if you're arguing, which I hear you started out by saying they're enforceable consent before assignment provisions, then that would mean that no, even if there's a loss, even post-loss, there could be no assignment, period. It doesn't matter if it's first-party insurance, doesn't matter if it's third-party insurance, right, if I'm just looking at the words of the contract?
If there was a situation, which factually is not presented here, where Wausau had breached its duty to defend old Waukesha Foundry or new Waukesha Foundry, or failed to pay a settlement or a judgment, the duty to defend and the duty to indemnify. And those rights had vested to a breach of contract claim, that could be assignable just like any assigned claim to a tort victim, for example.
And vested how?
Vested how?
Yes.
So on the duty to defend is very clear under the Wausau policies. There has to be a suit seeking damages caused by an occurrence resulting in bodily injury. Okay, so at the time of the alleged assignments here, both in 68 and 1990, there was no suit seeking damages. There was no tender to Wausau. There was no denial by Wausau. So there were no vested rights, no cause of action or choice of action that could be transferred. And the difference, I think, that you may be getting at is the provision talks about an interest in the policy. The case law talks about an assignment of a chose of action. Our position is completely consistent with the trilogy of the Supreme Court cases, which, by the way, all three of them were decided before occurrence policies even existed, like the Wausau policies. But we concede that if there was a vested chose of action for breach of contract, if Wausau had breached its duty to defend and or breached its duty to indemnify its insureds before the alleged assignments took place in 68 or 90, that would have been a vested right that could have been chose of action, a debt, if you will. If you want to use the language of those three cases, at that point it's a debt. It can be readily transferred as a property right as opposed to a contract right like a duty to defend, which is ongoing and requires a relationship with the insured. So the identity in that situation of the insured dramatically matters.
Why does the debt matter based on the filing of the cause of action? The debt is the debt.
The debt is if the cause of action was filed, it was tendered to the insurer, and the insurer denied coverage. At that point, you have a vested right for a chose of action or a cause of action for breach of contract.
And you're saying that's the chosen action. The chosen action is not the fact that there was a hero's asbestos, that there were damages from, assuming the claim is proven, that occurred back in the 1960s.
Absolutely.
That's irrelevant.
That fits well with a first-party claim because the loss there occurs, and assuming the insured complies with the conditions, provides a proof of loss, there is a loss. So the only obligation at that point is a debt that is readily assignable. The relationship between the insurer and the insured has been transferred from that of debt of insured to debtor and creditor. So the chose of action can be assigned. That doesn't fit. It's like putting a square peg in a round hole with third-party claims because there's an ongoing duty to defend. And so there's no debt that's been reduced that can be easily transferred as a property right, which is what those cases we're talking about. So our position is entirely consistent with Doge, Elkin, and Max L. Bloom.
Counsel, but when FASA projects what they have to put aside to meet claims during the year, they have to project the amount to defend claims as well, not just the payout, if there is a payout.
A reserve is set on actual claims. Here, at the time of these alleged transfers in 68 and 90, there were no claims for which a reserve could be set. So there was never a reserve set for what we're talking about.
I'm not talking about a reserve. I'm talking about when WASA is doing business, just doing business,
yes,
and they're going to meet claims that come up, hopefully not too many, but meeting those claims, they have to also, in their financial projection, project defense of those claims, or they will be, I mean, sometimes the defense is more than the payout of the claim.
There's no reserve set on unfiled claims.
No.
I mean, it could be a class action versus a small case in Eau Claire County that may have totally different defense costs.
You're using a different term than I'm using, but go ahead.
I think the question goes to not the reserve set upon the filing of a claim, but rather the amount charged for the premium. I may be wrong on that, but that's what I hear in the question. In other words, they set a premium for their potential liability for indemnification, right? That's what a premium
Correct.
Is. Is a premium, don't they, as I hear the question, don't they also charge a premium, even though it's undefinable in amount, for duty to defend, the two aspects of this liability policy?
It isn't calculated that cleanly, but a premium is set based on the risk of the insured, the characteristics of the insured. And part of that analysis is who is the identity of the insured. So changing the insured without the consent of the insurer changes that calculus, because we insured Little Waukesha Foundry. We didn't insure Big Abex Corporation. That would be like if WASA had issued a policy to New Glarus Brewing Company, and that was assigned without our consent to Anheuser-Busch. Anheuser-Busch's presence in litigation, just like Abex or Pneumo Abex's presence in litigation, far, far exceeds what Little Waukesha Foundry's presence is. That's the increased risk to WASA that we've experienced by this alleged assignment. Is now we're in a situation where claims are being tendered to us for Pneumo Abex's liability as a successor to Abex, which have nothing to do with Old Waukesha or New Waukesha Foundry. And if there is a doubt as to whether there is a duty to defend and whether that four corners of the complaint alleges a potential claim against a Waukesha Foundry product, we would have to defend Pneumo Abex in relation to all of its other exposed liabilities. And that comes to roost in the Huff case, because there's specific allegations of a conspiracy by Abex in the 1940s. That's not Waukesha Foundry's liability.
But counsel, when we have a duty to defend, if only, excuse me, one claim is potentially viable, the duty is there. So maybe the conspiracy runs out the window. But that doesn't get you away from the duty to defend.
That's where we have an increased risk, both in terms of the profile of cases, the number of cases. There wasn't a history of Waukesha Foundry being sued. It was a few cases here and there, old or new. Now all of a sudden we're faced with a different alleged insured who's getting sued in every jurisdiction, who's a well-known, ubiquitous defendant. And so the number of claims and the type of claims. Now we're defending Pneumo Abex for Abex. And Abex manufactured their own brake products with asbestos and other types of products, but they also acquired numerous companies. So now we're defending not just Old Waukesha Foundry or New Waukesha Foundry in a few cases, but we're in every jurisdiction and we're defending Pneumo Abex for Abex's own products and for Abex's products that they acquired, companies that they acquired over time that they would be liable for.
And how many other insurance companies are there as well? Because the only thing you, even though you have a duty to defend, the only thing you're liable for is this period of time, correct? So how many other insurance companies are there?
There are no other insurers for Waukesha Foundry.
No, I'm not asking for Waukesha Foundry. I'm asking for this. You're saying the duty to defend, this giant duty. It's so onerous. This puts us in this terrible position. The reality is that you would be responsible for that period of time, those years that Waukesha Foundry was covered. This lawsuit now, how many insurance companies are there?
None. Wausau is the only one. So these claims are just being tendered to Wausau.
So there's no other claims for any other period of time?
Correct. All of the claims involved in this lawsuit are being tendered to one insurer, even though ABEX had its own insurance, Pneumo ABEX had its own insurance, the companies that ABEX acquired over time had their own insurance.
It's Wausau that issued the policy during the time when the injury occurred, right?
ABEX issued had insurers who had issued policies during the same time.
ABEX wasn't even in existence in the claimed period.
Oh, sure they were.
Well, they are not the ones that's put out in the complaint. And the complaint clearly sets out all the way from the new Waukesha Foundry all the way through to the present day.
The complaint does not, I'm sorry, Your Honor, but if you look at the Huff complaint, neither old Waukesha Foundry or new Waukesha Foundry are not mentioned anywhere.
They're not. But I don't think there's any law that says you have to mention every person in the chain of responsibility in the complaint.
There may not be law to that specificity,
right,
but there at least has to be an allegation or an inference from an allegation that what we're talking about is a product that was made by old or new Waukesha Foundry. You cannot glean from the four corners of the Huff complaint any allegation that Pneumo ABEX is being held accountable because as a successor to Waukesha Foundry, old or new. The only allegation we have is a one-sentence line which identifies a different defendant, SPX, as a successor for Waukesha Pumps. And SPX manufactured their own products. They have a word mark for Waukesha Pumps. They acquired the right to use that entire division from ABEX. So how do we know from that complaint that the plaintiff is not intending to hold SPX, who they've sued on that basis, accountable for the exposure to the products it manufactured that was called Waukesha Pumps?
So they may not have been Waukesha's pumps. If we look at old or new Waukesha in the context of this case, they could be SPX pumps,
right,
but they're simply using the word mark.
Yes, the entire division was sold by ABEX to SPX. So SPX thereafter acquired the word mark and started manufacturing their own products. The only reasonable inference from the Huff complaint that we can make is that the plaintiff's intending to hold SPX liable for Waukesha Pumps exposures for products it manufactured as well.
Counsel, I want to return to the policy language because we always start there, and the policy language is typically dispositive, but we have, I'll call it the trilogy of cases as you had starting in 1880 that basically overrode the policy language in the first party context. Is that correct?
Correct.
And am I correct that in 1880 and at all times when this trilogy of cases came down, third-party insurance, particularly in the CGL context, didn't even exist?
That's correct. CGL policies came into an existence in 1941. The Wausau policies are occurrence-based policies. They came into existence in 1966.
Is it your argument, then, that what the Court of Appeals did in this case was to extend a ruling from 1880 when third-party insurance didn't even exist? It mapped that on to a context in which it never applied?
Correct. And if you look at, I think it's paragraph 29 of the Court of Appeals decision, it said, quote, a longstanding rule in Wisconsin that consent before assignment provisions in a third-party occurrence policy like the Wausau policies do not require consent before assignment. There's no reference to third-party policies or occurrence in any of those three decisions because they didn't even exist at the time. So that conclusion itself is an error. There was the longstanding rule in Wisconsin doesn't apply to third-party occurrence policies. The only The only case that's addressed that issue is Red Arrow.
And maybe an analogy might be helpful to illustrate the difference between first-party and third-party insurance. Let's say I have a homeowner's policy. There's a burglary at my house. I make a claim, and I have the right to recover $2,000. I owe Justice Hagedorn $2,000. I assign my right to recover from my insurance company to him. I can do that, correct, under the trilogy of cases, even if there is a non-assignment.
Right. It's been reduced to a debt. It's a property right. It's readily assignable under the trilogy of cases.
Right. And that does. Your argument is that that does not translate into the third-party duty to defend context because I'm afraid to draw an analogy. But I mean, we can use this circumstance, right, the facts of this case. We have a succession of companies, and at this point now it's Pepsi that is seeking to recover the or get the duty to defend under a policy that was issued to companies many decades ago, and there's claims in the complaint that have nothing to do with Waukesha, old or new for that matter, and so the insurer in this case is being asked to defend claims that it never received a premium for, it never agreed to insure. Is that correct?
That's correct. And the identity of the insured is very important with the duty to defend because it's a personal relationship. We can go back to contracts 101. It's a personal service to defend the insured, and the obligation of the insured is to cooperate. And the risk that is underwritten also has to do with the persona of the company.
I'm sorry to interrupt. It's more than just the duty to cooperate. I mean, to me, this would be comparable. Maybe not exactly, but it would be comparable to an insurance company writing a policy to insure on an indemnification basis, a 50-year-old person giving them an auto policy, and then that person wants to assign it to a 16-year-old who insurance companies, I think everybody would recognize, presents a greater risk. It would not be assignable in that context, right?
No offense to our crowd, but you're absolutely correct.
No offense
correct.
At all.
So, counsel, if this is so basic and understandable, tell me about the rest of the country, because I was only able to find one case, and that's Indiana, that makes this distinction that you're asking us to make between the third and first party policies.
I believe, Your Honor, it's footnote 6 in our reply brief. We listed the cases that support us. I think there's...
Right. None of those talk about the distinction between first and third the way you cited to them. Only Indiana actually makes that distinction.
All six or seven, I can't remember the count, are third-party policies. In fact, the Aeromotive case is very similar to our case. Actually, it's more similar to Red Arrow out of Michigan.
Sure.
Because
and
it's
there are states that don't allow it, period, whether it's first or third. I'm asking for your proposition to us today, and this is kind of where we started,
yes,
is that there is this distinction between third and first. And I understand your argument. I'm asking you first, where is the support for that in the law? I don't see it in... Williston on contracts, I don't see it on Couch on insurance, and I don't see it in any case other than that Indiana case. So what you're asking us to do is something really unique. We could be a state that doesn't allow it, period, no assignment, no matter what, look at the language, follow the language, or we could be a state that allows post-loss assignment that piece, right, that liability piece, which I understand goes along with duty to defend. But where are the cases, where are the states that make this distinction where it's only applicable in the first-party context?
All the cases we've cited are, first of all, third-party claims. Now, whether they all went in detail on the differences between the two, it depends on what the briefing was and what the questions were in oral argument. But U.S. Filter does. But in response to what you said about Williston and Couch, our position is completely consistent and supported by those treatises because what Pepsi Metro is attempting to do is get an assignment of coverage, not an assignment of a choice of action because they would have nothing. There was no breach of the duty to defend, no breach of the duty to indemnify at the time of transfer. So there's no assignment of a choice of action. They're seeking to have Pneumo Abex be substituted in the shoes of Waukesha Foundry as the insured and have a full entitlement of rights of coverage under the policies. That's different than an assignment of a choice of action. And all of those treatises identify that difference between assigning coverage, including the duty to defend, and assigning a choice of action, which is a debt that's easily transferable, as in the example that Justice Bradley gave with respect to the $2,000 to Justice Hagedorn.
Counsel, you talk about coverage, and I mentioned this before in my question comment. And that was that coverage has the two components, the duty to defend and the indemnification. We're here, the procedural posture is a partial summary judgment motion on the duty to defend. Your arguments in part deal with the unanticipated costs that are unique to duty to defend, which is the subject of your motion. You just said that identity of the defendant is important in duty to defend. Yet it appears to me that a premium was paid for the other part of coverage, indemnification. Do you disagree that a premium was paid for indemnification?
No, and if I can just correct you. So Pepsi Metro had filed a motion for partial summary judgment only on the duty to defend.
Okay.
Wausau cross-motioned for summary judgment and declaratory judgment as to both.
Okay.
Now, in reality, the only cases we have are duty to defend cases because there was only one indemnity case, and it was SPX's indemnity, and the trial court determined that SPX is not an insured, so we had no obligation. Pepsi Metro did not appeal that. That's not part of this appeal. So
I appreciate that correction. So you're not contesting that a premium was paid for that part of coverage in third party, which is the indemnification. You're not contesting that.
No.
Okay.
No.
So can there be a duty to defend and not a duty to indemnify? Let me ask that a little more specifically. I always think of the duty to defend as broader than the duty to indemnify and encompassing. So if we determine that based on all the changes in terms of the identity of the parties, given all of the progression of the identities here, that there is no duty to defend, is there remaining a duty to indemnify since premium was paid for that?
I'm past my time. May I answer your question?
Yes, you may.
Okay, thank you. There are certainly circumstances in which an insurer has a duty to defend and they get out on summary judgment, the insured does, so there's never a liability. But that's a really important point for purposes of indemnification because the insurer's obligation in a third-party context is so different than the first-party context because the indemnity obligation arises under the policy when the insured is legally obligated to pay damages. That's either a judgment or a settlement. So unlike in a first-party loss situation where the fire occurs or the burglary happens, as in that example that the justice gave, that loss occurs immediately. In an occurrence situation, the insurer has no obligation to its insured at the time of the exposure to asbestos. That individual may never get sick, may never file a case, and the insured may have all sorts of defenses that never lead to indemnity. So the obligation in the third-party context, contractually and clearly, is that the insured is legally obligated to pay damages. That does not happen at the time of the exposure. So we can't equivalate loss and occurrence. They just don't fit together.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm David Salmons on behalf of Pepsi Metropolitan Bottling Company. I think the court. Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you. My apologies, Lee, for jumping the gun.
Are you a Wisconsin lawyer?
I am not, Your Honor. I'm here on pro hoc, and I thank the court for the opportunity to present our...
Has he been admitted? Okay, that's all I needed to know. Thank you. Please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. this court's longstanding post-loss rule applies with full force to both the duty to indemnify and the duty to defend inherent in third-party coverage. That is true as a matter of established precedent, the plain terms of the contract, and principles of public policy and basic fairness. Let me start with precedent. This court has been a leader in the development of the post-loss rule, and its decisions in Doge, Alcan, and Bloom made clear long before the parties included this anti-assignment provision in these policies that this contractual language only requires consent for pre-loss assignments of rights. Once a loss has occurred, coverage under the policy is triggered, and all that is left is the insured's right to enforce the benefits it is owed under the contract. And that contractual right is freely assignable, even if the amount of those benefits is not yet known. As Doge and Bloom put it, at the time of loss, the insurer's coverage risk has ceased, and the insured is free to assign its contractual rights to benefits. What's more, this court's decision in Ladwig makes clear that when parties to an insurance policy include language that has been authoritatively interpreted by this court, they are deemed to intend that meaning. As the court put it in Ladwig, to declare at this time that the language means something else would be to defeat the clearly expressed intention of the parties to the contract. Here, at the time the contracts were entered into, this court had consistently read this language to refer only to pre-loss assignments. The Ocean Accident and the Maryland Casualty cases, both of which were decided long before this policy was entered into, relied on this court's cases to hold that the post-loss rule applies to third-party coverage and the duty to defend.
So the Court of Appeals and the dissent and your friend on the other side keep pointing us to Red Arrow. And I think it's your position that Red Arrow is not applicable in this situation. Can you explain to me why?
Sure, Your Honor. Fundamentally, we think Red Arrow just did not address this question. The only question in Red Arrow was whether rights had transferred as a matter of law. The opinion itself makes clear that there was no assignment. It was conceded that there was no assignment. If you look at Wausau's brief in that case, at Appendix 202, very clear, he says, as established above, New Red Arrow does not dispute that the Wausau policies were not assigned nor transferred to it under the sale agreement. The sentence that they rely on says that Wausau's policies made clear that without Wausau's permission, no assignee or transferee has any right to benefits under the Wausau policies. That's a statement that describes the policy language. There's no reference to the duty to defend. There's no reference to a distinction between first and third party policies. There's no reference to this court's long standing cases about the post-loss rule, and the only case that's cited after that statement, Lowenstein, is a first-party assignment case. So we think fundamentally Red Arrow just did not address this issue. Whether you call it dicta or you just distinguish the case on its terms, clearly I would submit the Court of Appeals must have the authority to interpret its own cases and figure out how to apply it going forward, even if it certainly is limited by Cook and Lardar and the kinds of things it can do. But I think here the Court of Appeals was within the proper boundaries in just distinguishing a case that actually did not resolve the issue. And whatever else may be true, there is no evidence whatsoever that insurers were relying on Red Arrow, a statement that has no discussion of the distinction between first and third-party policies, that makes no reference at all to the post-loss rule, as somehow significantly altering the scope of that rule in cases going forward. So that reliance argument doesn't work. The reliance argument that does is that when the parties entered into this language, there was only one interpretation that any court had applied to that language. And no court anywhere had interpreted this anti-assignment language, which goes back to the 1800s, as drawing
but
a distinction.
Counsel, in the 1800s, third-party insurance didn't exist, right?
So no, that's not correct, Your Honor.
Tell me when I didn't mean to cut you off.
But I think that's a mistake that the other side is pressing. If you look at the Maryland Court of Appeals case from, I believe it is 1896, it applied the post-loss rule.
I'm not talking about Maryland. I'm talking about Wisconsin.
Sure, but I think the broader point that was made by my friend on the other side is that there just simply were not third-party coverage policies, occurrence policies in existence at the time of this court's cases. And my point is that's not true. You can look at that Maryland case. You can look at the two Eighth Circuit decisions that we cite to Maryland Casualty and Ocean Accident, both of whom cite to this court's cases and apply the post-loss rule to third-party policies long before that. The one case is 1907, the other is 1939. Clearly, occurrence policies were in existence, third-party policies were in existence prior to that time. So,
Other jurisdictions don't bind us if they misinterpret our cases, right?
Well, certainly that's true. But the question I think that for the court here, in part, is what were the expectations of and intent of the parties at the time they entered into this contract?
And this contract says there's no assignment without the consent of the insurer. So if your position is correct that in 1880 this court simply disposed of non-assignment clauses, why are they still in insurance policies?
Well, they still have effect during the period of the policy, Your Honor. They still do work. They just don't apply after a loss has occurred. And so with regard to this contract, I would like to make a couple of points about the plain language of the language, if I may, which is that there's no dispute that this anti-assignment provision appears in a section of the policy that applies to the policy as a whole, not to any particular kind of coverage. And by its terms, it speaks to assigning interest in the policy without any mention of the type of coverage. And there's no dispute that the policies here were combination policies that had both first and third-party coverage inherent in them. And there's no principle of contract interpretation that would allow the court to take the exact same language and apply it one way to one type of coverage and the opposite to another type of coverage when, by its terms, it applies to the entire policy. So either you're going to deviate from the party's intent by giving that clear language opposite meanings, or you're going to follow the principle of Ladwig, which is that when the policy was entered into, this court, take Bloom, for example. Bloom is very clear, not just about public policy, but also about how this language will be interpreted going forward. And what Bloom says is that we are of the opinion that the language of the policies prohibiting assignment of the policies refers only to assignments before loss and does not refer to assignments of the chosen in action after loss. So there's a pre-loss meaning inherent in this language at the time the parties included it. That's what the parties intended by the meaning. And to change that meaning now for third-party coverage would be, as the court in Ladwig said, to defeat the intent of the parties to the contract. The other problem, Your Honor, is that the argument the other side makes fundamentally is that the duty to defend in particular, but third-party coverage as a whole, is somehow always part of the coverage of the policy and is not a right that can be assigned at post a loss. Their argument is not really, there was some reference to it today, but if you look at their briefs, their argument is not really that the loss occurs at a different time under an occurrence policy. Their reply brief, for example, says it's not about when, it's about what is being assigned. And their argument fundamentally is that this is part of coverage. We heard that today as well. And I would submit that this court's decision, unanimous decision in 2015 in the Anderson case, completely forestalls that argument. So in Anderson, what was at issue? Well, in Anderson, this court held that the state's notice prejudice statutes apply to occurrence policies like those at issue here, but do not apply to claims made and reported policies. And the reason the court gave for the difference is how each type of policy defines the elements of coverage. Every member of this court agreed with this statement. Quote, occurrence policies provide coverage if the negligent act or omission occurs within the policy period, regardless of the date the claim is made or asserted. That is because, the court said, it is the timing of the event causing injury, not the assertion or reporting of a claim based on the injury that triggers the grant of coverage. Because coverage of the policy is set at the time of occurrence, the court held, the legislature did not override timely, could override timely reporting requirements in an occurrence policy and require a finding of prejudice to deny benefits. And in contrast, the court said that those statutes did not apply to a claims made in reported policy precisely because those policies include the element of the timing of the suit and the reporting that triggers the duty to defend as an element of coverage. There's no way to reconcile the position that my friend on the other side is urging with this court's decision in Anderson. Coverage under occurrence policies is set at the time of the occurrence.
The problem that I'm having with your argument is that we're not looking at claims that relate back to old or new Waukesha's products, right? All it takes to trigger the duty to defend is one claim that triggers coverage, but we have a whole slew of claims that have nothing to do with any products that the original insured manufactured. Do you agree with that?
So I do not, Your Honor. If I may explain.
Okay, tell me why.
The thing that triggers coverage here, regardless of whether there was an assignment or not, we're 50 years past the time these policies were issued. That the court in Anderson, one of the things the court noted was the long tail exposure inherent in occurrence policies. So we're 50 years on. No one should have expected when these policies were issued that 50 years in the future the Waukesha entities would have the same management or would have the same business operations or scope of business. There's a ton of risk that's just inherent in the long-term exposure.
Right,
but
isn't that why insurance companies put the anti-assignment clauses in so that they can have a say in whether they're willing to accept the risk that the successor corporations pose to them? I mean, well, California case put it this way. I mean, you're basically asking the insurance company to enter into a contract unwillingly with a stranger. The policy premium was never priced to take account of defending claims or covering claims of successor corporations involving products and industries that the original insured was never a part of.
Yeah, I think, again, Your Honor, I'm going to respectfully disagree with that statement, and I'll give you an example from this case. So a big part of the supposed increased risk that's asserted here relates to the combination of the pumps business with the brakes business that took place in 1972 through a merger, not through an assignment at all. And so they don't even make – so that they concede in their reply brief in footnote 5 that that merger and all mergers have nothing to do with these assignment this assignment provision and the risks that are involved. So there's a lot of ways in which the responsibility to defend claims will have to be made on the part of businesses that are fundamentally different than at the time the policies were issued.
How would an insurance company price premiums if it is going to be forced to not only cover claims that are completely unrelated to the risk it agreed to insure? How would they possibly price that? Back in the 1960s, when this insurance company was contracting with old Waukesha, how could they possibly predict which companies, decades and decades and decades on, might acquire, merge with that company? I mean, you're talking about claims in this complaint that have nothing to do with
no,
the
Honor.
Products provided by Waukesha.
The circuit court and the court of appeals looked at the complaint and concluded on the four corners of the complaint it does trigger claims that go back to the Waukesha pumps business.
Correct.
That was insured during that time period.
But
there are other claims in the case.
Counsel, the duty to defend is not isolated to the claims that relate to the products provided by old Waukesha. Okay, this insurance company now has to defend all the claims in the complaint.
Well,
my question for you is, how in 1968 or whenever this policy was first issued, how is an insurance company supposed to price that risk?
Your Honor, my answer to you is that they've already done so. And let me illustrate why. Because
counsel, that's just mathematically impossible.
Well, if I may answer, Your Honor, I'll do my best to explain why it's not. And that is that imagine that you have all the same transactions that you have here, but that the Waukesha entities were the surviving entities each time, so that you have, you know, Waukesha today, 50 years later, that has the same business elements that we're talking about now and is subject to the same lawsuits. There's no dispute.
Correct.
That Waukesha would have a duty to defend, notwithstanding that there might be other claims inherent in that. And to me, what that demonstrates and what I would urge the court to see is that the risks they're really talking about are not assignment risks at all. They're risks that of the fundamental changes and evolution of business entities over time. And that is what this court in Anderson said was the long tail exposure. That was the term the court used. Inherent in occurrence policies, because it's impossible fully for them to predict how much premiums to charge when you don't know how things are going to play out 50 years later when the claims are filed. But that's not an assignment risk. Those are risks, to be sure, but they were risks that they were paid full premiums to compensate them for at the time. That risk of how events would play out differently over time and what the circumstances would be when injuries finally manifested after asbestos exposure, for example, are risks they deal with and they insured all the time. The only difference here is that the business community engaged in transactions in reliance upon the post-loss principle that ended up with the surviving entity not being Old and New Waukesha, but they assigned them to others. At the time they did so, they had every reason to expect that those assignments would be respected because they were after the coverage had been set, after the risks related to coverage, as the court said in Doge, had ceased, and therefore they would be respected. And those transactions, a decision now, after the fact, would provide a massive windfall to the insurers. If you adopt their position, they have been paid full premiums to provide a defense for these claims far into the future. The defense they have to provide is not different whether there was an assignment or there was not an assignment. It's only the same claims for the same business, the pumps business, that were the result of the same occurrences during the same policy period.
Are you denying that the complaint does not state claims related to products produced by companies other than Old or New Waukesha? Are you denying that?
No, the Huff complaint, if you look at the Huff complaint, and I would urge the court to do so.
I have.
It's that Huff complaint states claims against a whole host of defendants. That's the nature of asbestos complaints. That's what they look like. And included in those are ABEX and Pneumo ABEX. And there's no dispute that it references the policy period. There's references to the successor in interest of the Waukesha entities. And there's also a reference to Waukesha pumps. So the position that we have, and I think it's the position, you know, and I would urge the court to look at pages 4 and 5 of the circuit court's decision. It said the case is based on numerous lawsuits alleging injury caused by exposure to asbestos. Many of the complaints allege the asbestos resulted from exposure to pumps or other products manufactured or sold by the Waukesha foundry entity, and makes reference to the same points I just made about the policy period, about the naming of the successor entities, to conclude that those complaints trigger the issues here. If the court below, if the circuit court even, did not find that the complaint triggered those issues, there would have been no need to analyze the post-loss rule or anything else, because the complaints wouldn't have triggered a duty to defend. So we think the complaint clearly does, but if there's issues with regard to that, remember that insurers have a number of available options based on this court's cases to what they do if they want to dispute the scope of their defense obligations. They can reserve rights, they can move to stay, and then litigate the duty to defend. When the fact develops, they can start off and reserve rights. When the fact development takes place, if they determine that Mr. Huff never came in contact with any Waukesha pump products, they can cease defense at that point and seek reimbursement. There are a number of options that they have. All of those risks would be there if the Waukesha entities were still in existence today and you had this same kind of a suit filed. You'd have to sort all of these things out. But what the post-loss rule focuses on, Your Honors, is not just those kinds of long-tail uncertainties. It focuses on the coverage risks, and the court has concluded, and all of the courts that apply the post-loss rule consistently between first and third-party policies do so because the coverage is settled and triggers a right. It's a contingent right, to be sure, to receive benefits under the policy. You have to litigate when the time comes. If the injury is really tied back to the occurrence and all of the rights and obligations that the original insured has are transferred to the assignee, so they have to cooperate, they have to provide information, they have to file a timely claim, they have to do all of those other things. But their risk is not meaningfully increased by the assignment. It's still the same claims that they have to defend. And then the one last point I would make with
I want to ask you a question. Maybe this is your last point. I'm not sure. But assume that we find in your favor regarding the post-loss assignment rule. We still have to then narrow down our analysis and look right at the Huff complaint, correct?
Yes, I think the court certainly could. I know that it has to, but yes.
If we decide to do that, the complaint doesn't name the companies that Wausau insured, right? It doesn't name Old Waukesha or New Waukesha, but it's your contention that it names Pneumo Abex and Abex Corporation, but it doesn't name the Waukesha companies. So how do we connect those dots for me? Because I'm not sure I quite understand your argument.
Sure. Thank you, Your Honor. Again, I would point the court to even the analysis that the circuit court did on this issue on page 4 to 5 of their order. Among other things, that court pointed to the fact that the complaints name one or more of the following companies and corporations as defendants: Waukesha Foundry Company for some of the complaints, Pneumo Abex, Waukesha Barrel, and some others that were successors of the Waukesha Pumps. There's also a reference to Waukesha Pumps itself in the complaint, and you can find that. Again, the pages in the appendix are 112, 135, and 137 that form the allegations that were sufficient to trigger at least an initial duty to defend to sort out.
I don't want to interrupt you, but I do want to get your references more accurately. I've read the complaint, and I don't see the reference that you're talking about to Waukesha. And are you talking about the Huff complaint?
I am, yes, Your Honor.
Okay, if you could, I don't want you to take too much time because
your argument's going
to go very fast. But if you could give me just the page of the complaint.
Sure, I would point to, this is page 7 of the complaint. It's in the supplemental appendix 112.
Okay, I got it right in front of me.
Here what you have at the beginning is a description of the time period that the plaintiff here is claiming exposure, and you'll see that it tracks with the time period for the policies. Then on page 30 of the complaint, this is supplemental appendix 135, they specifically name defendant Pneumo Abex, LLC, a successor in interest to Abex Corporation, which are successors of the Waukesha.
Well, I agree that they fit. I just didn't see Waukesha Pump's name.
What you then see is on a supplemental appendix 137, page 32 of the Huff complaint. There's a reference to defendant SPX Corp on behalf of Waukesha Pumps.
Got it. Thank you.
And so those are the places we'd cite you. Those are the indications that both the circuit court and the Court of Appeals pointed to in their analysis of the Huff complaint. Just one thing I would add with regard to that as well is, as my friend on the other side has indicated, they moved to dismiss everything, not just related to the Huff complaint. And the circuit court's reference to a broader range of complaints is relevant if the court were to consider reversing and granting their motion to dismiss, because it's much broader in that sense. So I would point that out for the court's consideration. And then, if I may, I'd just like to address an issue that I think has come up a couple of times, which is the notion that in first-party assignment context, everybody knows how much money we're talking about, that the amount of the claim is settled, and then therefore the certainty with regard to the amount, it makes it a chosen action, whereas the contingent nature and uncertainty in the third-party context prevents it from being a chosen action. I would point out that they've cited no principle of Wisconsin law that requires that level of certainty before rights under a contract can be assigned. The restatement second makes clear that contingent and uncertain rights are assignable. But the premise of their argument that first-party coverage cases are certain is really humorous if you actually look at the facts of Bloom and Alcan, for example. And if the Court will indulge me, I'll just read a little bit from this Court's opinion in Bloom, where what was issued there were burglary policies. And the Court addressed each one of these issues before it got to the assignment. The Court said that the defendant insurer denied that there was any burglary of the plaintiff's goods, denied that the plaintiff suffered any loss, denied that the plaintiff established its claim by direct and affirmative evidence as required by the policies, denied that the plaintiff established that there were visible marks by tools at the place of entry as required by the policies, denied that the plaintiff kept books from which the loss could be estimated as required by the policies, claimed that the insured fraudulently staged the break-in, that the premises were not kept reasonably secure, that the stolen goods were encumbered by mortgages contrary to the policies, and that the damages were excessive and utterly speculative. All of those were issues in the first-party context that this Court resolved, which just shows that it's a myth that first-party policy assignments don't involve contingent rights. They absolutely do.
So can you respond, Counsel? What I heard Attorney Cohn arguing was that he's not disputing the idea of a chosen action. I think I heard him saying that the chosen action for a third-party claim is not until the claim is actually filed, whereas in a first-party claim, it's at the time of the loss. So can you...
Well, I think, Your Honor, the best I can do is that seems to be premised on a completely unsupported, in Wisconsin law, assumption that in order to assign a contingent right under a contract, you have to have certainty with regard to the amount that it's at issue. And I think it's the opposite. The law is clear. They don't cite anything that says a contractual right to be assigned has to be calculable at that point. It can be a contingent right. And then what matters, again, from this Court's cases, from all the other cases that go our way, and the overwhelming majority do.
Well, hang on there, Counsel. There isn't any case in the state of Wisconsin that has extended the post-loss doctrine beyond indemnity until the Court of Appeals decision in this case. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
You're asking us to change Wisconsin law. You're asking us to expand an 1880 case that has never been expanded before until the Court of Appeals did so, contrary, arguably, to Red Arrow.
No, Your Honor. With respect, what I would say is that we ask this Court to apply the fundamental principles articulated in those cases to the context of third party. And we don't think that this is a meaningful extension or deviation.
There's
in
a
any
big
way.
Difference between indemnity and defense.
Well, Your Honor, there's indemnity and third party coverage as well, and they're seeking to get out from under it. Simply because there happened to be an assignment. And they've not really provided any meaningful argument as to why their indemnity obligation should disappear because of something about the duty to defend. With regard to the duty to defend, I would just remind the Court that if they can satisfy their duty to defend by reimbursing our attorney's fees. They have a right to participate and do more, but this idea of like this inherent personal relationship, I think, is also a myth. It's 50 years since the policies were written. If they were working with the Waukesha entities, they would not be working with the management team that they had a personal relationship with in the 1960s and 70s. And from the insurance point of view, they are insuring against economic harms that come to them as a result of an occurrence during the policy period. Those economic harms are the value of the claim they might have to pay out, and the cost of defending against that claim. And I would urge the Court to look at the Ocean Accident decision from the Eighth Circuit, which lays out how I think most courts approach the duty to defend here, which is that in the third-party context, It really is a mode of proof that's equivalent to the process of filing a claim and proof of claim in the first-party context. It's much more expensive, but it is the way of determining that the suit stems from and results from the injury at the time. It's not a separate right in that sense that couldn't be assigned. It's a right. It is a right to monies from the point of view of the insurance. The last point I would make, Your Honor, I'm sorry, I see my time is up.
Yeah, you can finish up with
I'll be very brief. Thank you, Your Honor. I just want to make this point that the parties here knew what this language meant when they included it, and no court had ever applied it to post-loss in any circumstance at the time they included it. Business entities have relied on the ability to assign post-loss rights throughout these transactions and throughout the, you know, Wisconsin business for decades, and injured parties need these assets that were fully funded and paid for with premiums at the time. They should not escape and obtain that windfall merely because there was an assignment here, because if there wasn't, there's no doubt they'd be on the hook. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Let me just address a couple points here. I think my opposing counsel made a couple misstatements to the court that I'd like to correct. First of all, the ocean accident case that he's talking about is not an occurrence policy. The occurrence policies didn't exist until 1966. That decision was in the late 30s, and it dealt with an employer's liability policy, which in Wisconsin we call workers' compensation. So it wasn't applying the post-loss rule to a third-party occurrence policy. So that was a misstatement, and the Maryland case is the same. It did not involve an occurrence policy. The second misstatement is counsel advised, Your Honors, that the circuit court below found that Wausau had a duty to defend. That is not true. The circuit court held that we did not have a duty to defend the Huff case because it accepted our argument that nowhere in the four corners of the complaint in the Huff case does it mention old Waukesha Foundry, new Waukesha Foundry, or that the plaintiff was seeking to hold Pneumo Abex as successor to Abex responsible for any exposure to old or new Waukesha Foundry products. The paragraphs of the trial court decision that counsel referred to was a recitation of what Pepsi Metro was claiming in the declaratory judgment complaint. It wasn't a finding or conclusion of the court. He was stating what Pepsi was alleging in the case. But the decision of the trial court was that we didn't have a duty to defend. And the judge continued, because he wanted to be complete, to address the assignment. Secondly, let me address the argument that was made that at the time of the policies being issued, the policies intended for the 1880s and 1928 cases to apply. I don't know how you could possibly glean that, because they dealt with first-party losses. They didn't deal with third-party losses. And in fact, at the time of the alleged assignment in 1968, the transaction between old Waukesha and new Waukesha expressly stated in the document that the reorganization agreement, that any contracts that required the consent of a party, and if that consent was not obtained, would not be transferred. And in that same document, it was very clear that old Waukesha Foundry was retaining liabilities to the extent of its insurance. So not only at the time of the policies did the language mean what it clearly and unambiguously says, because that's the contract interpretation that the courts apply, is you have to apply the language as written. There's no argument at all that there's ambiguity in that language.
I think the argument really was that this language has direct application when you're looking at a claim made during the policy period.
I don't know how the policies, that the parties to the Wausau policies could construe those cases to applying to that setting. If they had, they would have changed the language, as Justice Bradley suggested. Plus, we have a statute that comes into effect that specifically says that the policy can't be changed without the consent of the insurer. And that's very important. This is kind of glossed over here. Is, let's say that old Waukesha Foundry approached Wausau, or new Waukesha Foundry approached Wausau and said, we're about to do this transaction. Would you consent? At that time, the insurer has the opportunity to do some due diligence. and there may be a negotiation. There may be an additional premium. Oh, you're transacting with ABEX. I could see situations where we could be hailed into court because of ABEX products. We'll charge you an extra premium to endorse the policy. And much more, if that occurred and that negotiation happened and Wausau agreed, we wouldn't have to glean through transaction documents. We wouldn't have to be arguing about it because it would be clear as day. The endorsement would say whether the policies, the interests under the policies were transferred or not. And Wausau, a party to the policy, would have an opportunity to weigh in on that risk. I also want to address counsel's reliance on All versus Wisconsin. Let's not conflate the issue of late notice and prejudice with the issues in front of this court, because this case has nothing to do with late notice or prejudice. So that case is entirely distinguishable from this case. But what's more, the risks that the court was talking about with long-tail claims and occurrence policies aren't risks that your insured will merge with Enron or some other massive company. The risk that a long-tail policy involves is what we're dealing with now. Who thought that asbestos would last this long? Who thought asbestos claims would last? There are people who are claiming household exposure to their parents' exposure. Never even back at the time of the contract and the policies. So that's what this court was concerned about and talking about with respect to long-tail claims and risk, not the risk that some entirely different entity would be substituted as in your insured, and you'd incur that additional risk to defend them without a premium being paid.
Thank you,
Your Honor.
Well, the briefs were excellent. I have to tell you, it pleases us when we have two really smart lawyers, and they're both totally convinced they're right. Arguments were very good, too. Thank you so much. We are adjourned. The court will meet in closed conference in 40 minutes.